When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, welcome to the Akaat Disney podcast, where we uncover all of the secrets hidden behind the mouse. This is Matt here. Joining me, as always, is Thomas, the paranoid American. Howdy. Yeah, you got some real metal look right now. It's like Christmas metal. You've got the green in the background, and then your face is
beige. It's funny you say that.
I've got
like a Christmas cup, too, that I'm rocking for I don't know what reason. It just happened to be. So Merry Christmas.
No, I have my coffee in the morning, and it's the coffee mugs like say the month in them, and it's very, very rarely the month I'm drinking the coffee. I believe I was drinking May this morning, and this is August, of course. So, as long as it holds the liquid, I guess it's fine.
It would be nice to have the luxury of just having storage and time to just transfer like your Halloween mugs out with your Christmas mug, or I guess your Thanksgiving mugs, right? And then your Christmas mugs. I'm sure there's people out there that have just got like 12 months of mugs, but yeah, I'm kind of
we only have like three of the months. That's the thing, right? Like it's not, like, it would make more sense if we had all 12. The most fun, we live with my in-laws, and when we first came in, the key piece of glassery was, for some reason, they had like a Wacky Races cup, which is glass.
Wacky Races.
Yeah, that's like the is it Hanna-Barbera, I think,
Yeah.
It was just like so obscure and so specific. I was like, what, a Wacky Races mug or what? What's this? Okay, glass. I'm calling it the wrong thing.
You remember the old like Burger King and Denny's and like even like the old jelly glasses used to have all the old cartoon characters and stuff on them, and I've always wanted to go back and recollect them, but apparently they were made with like some kind of lead paint or some sort of unsafe materials, so they're actually not a good thing to drink out of anymore.
I think I heard something along those lines, so
lead paint. I'm just making something up, but it's not, it's something that you probably don't want to put in your body at this point.
That's the amount of knowledge I'm coming with. I remember hearing someone saying something about that, but
those are classic designs, man.
I guess you could collect the old lunch boxes, the metal lunch boxes. I mean, don't lick those, right? Because they probably do have lead paint.
But, yeah,
but as far as just like, something you could have, that's cool. Oliver and Company is today's movie, having a lot of... I thought it had a lot of product placement, but apparently it did not, at least in the animation end. Most of the logos and stuff you see were just there to make it authentically look like New York. Like they didn't want to... put fake names and stuff in. So
yeah, right as you were saying that, I kind of assumed that's what the case was, because then I was also trying to picture a slow zoom in of a bird's eye view of Times Square, New York City in the late 80s, I guess, early 90s ish, and imagine that without Kodak and Coca-Cola and like a whole bunch of advertisements all over the place. It would look weird. It wouldn't look like New York.
I was just hearing about the opposite. I was listening to someone's trip report of Meow Wolf's Omega Mart in Las Vegas. Have you heard of this?
I haven't.
Okay, it's a fake supermarket with fake products like art school funny. Like it's not like laugh out loud, it's just weird. But apparently as you explore this fake supermarket, you'll find hidden passages that go to like an alien warehouse or something with psychedelic lighting and art installations and stuff. So
okay, I'm like, into that. Do they just charge like a cover fee to get in?
That's right. It's like $35 to get in or whatever. And you just explore and you like, this refrigerator opens up and you can walk into it, into these like back corridors that go into like trippy land. And
do they provide the drugs or do you have to bring your own?
You have to bring your own drugs, unfortunately. So
an extra $35 plus on whatever the drug budget is.
Well, they got one in Vegas. They have something completely different in Denver, I believe. So, those are places you could probably easily
Yeah.
Do that.
That sounds awesome, actually. I might have to add that to the list.
Yeah. I mean, we got that kind of thing in Japan, but it's just like, it's not on the table in Japan, which is one of the things you have to accept living in Japan, for better or for worse. So you are on an island. So
yeah, no comment. We're not going to advocate anything.
No, we're not advocating anything. No. I'm just sitting here talking about the one end of Japanese boredom. but yeah, Oliver and Company, I think it's the first time I watched this film. It came out in 1988. So I'm pretty sure I was 9 years old. And I mean, my dad was very quickly dragging me into movies that were not animated. You know, I saw Ghostbusters and Return of Jedi and Back to the Future in theaters, probably slightly too young to do that. Oh, Temple of Doom, definitely too young for that. but yeah, I just didn't see it. And then when they re-released it, I also wouldn't have cared. And it was not on home video for the 8 years in between. So this one just never came on my radar, despite being the first animated Disney film to break 100 million globally.
Wow, that's actually surprising about that note. Or maybe it isn't, because I guess my biggest note on this whole movie is that it's the first movie that I'm aware of that breaks out of the fantasy land Disney that takes place in some like forgotten era. It takes place in modern day. And I can you think of another animated Disney movie that didn't take place in, you know, like the real world, essentially?
When I was going through the trivia, it said it was the fourth. It was saying Dumbo is contemporaneous, which, you know, makes sense. You're watching animals for most part.
Fair enough.
I wasn't sure about this one. They said 101 Dalmatians, but I was like, that wasn't that like earlier? I felt like that was earlier in 1960 or whatever.
That's a good one. I don't know. I mean, I guess because the 101 Dalmatians, though, also took place in a very Victorian-esque setting. You know what I mean? Like, even though this one was based on like a Victorian setting as well, they modernized it, whereas 101 Dalmatians doesn't feel as modernized. They had cars, but everyone was still sort of living in, like, a century prior, I guess.
Yeah, that one felt a little dodgery.
Or is that just England? Is that just England?
yeah. Maybe that's the post-war blues, you know, in England. So, and the other one they brought up, which actually there were times when it was considered
the Gnomobile. You're going to say the Gnomobile.
This would be a sequel to the Gnomobile, or the Rescuers, so to speak, which does get a sequel eventually, but this is not it. So they really wanted to sequelize the Rescuers. Like they you know, they had a stiffy for that, I guess, which is kind of weird.
They wanted to implant some more of that programming.
I guess that one
held up the longest.
Yeah. I guess the Rescuers is the most like sequelable. Is that a word? Sequelable. You could easily have like, oh, these mice have like another adventure, no problem, which eventually happens, right? So
my opinion, the second one is far better than the first one too. Not like story wise but just aesthetically, and it keeps my interest way longer.
That'll be new for me. The other, just while we're on like dollars and cents, this came out the same day as The Land Before Time. Which, so Bluth and Disney were in which direct
completely overshadowed this movie, in my opinion, for me personally.
And at opening weekend, it was number one. Oliver and Company was number four, but Oliver and Company stuck around in theaters longer and eventually made more money. Have I seen The Land Before Time or any of its 93 sequels? I'm not sure I've actually seen those either, to be honest. So
I feel like the corporate entity spirit of Disney at this point would not have allowed Land Before Time to show Oliver and Company up too much, just because it was the recently departed Don Bluth. So there was almost like, we'll throw some money into this just to overpower it.
yeah. That could be the thing. Just a little hate money, right? Dom DeLuise apparently chose this over Land Before Time, so maybe you made the wrong decision in your book. So
did Cheech Marin have an opportunity for Land Before Time?
I saw a list where he's done quite a few voiceovers, which you start thinking about, yeah, that makes sense. So
now just to ask the dumbest question that I could, that this was the real Cheech Marin that was in this movie, right? In Oliver and Company?
That is correct, yes.
Okay,
yes.
It would have been weird for someone to be doing such an on, you know, point personation of him.
Well, and that's ironic you said that, because another weird rabbit hole I was going down was the Legends in Concert, where they have, you know, like 30 impersonators on stage at various, like Myrtle Beach or again Vegas or Branson or something.
I'm not familiar with this. I mean, as you're explaining it, I understand the concept, but I haven't heard of that before. No.
If you see the logo, you might, especially living in Florida, you might recognize the logo. I think I remember it. I think they had a show at Six Flags or something when I was growing up, and the guy
it's that called Legends that, in Concert.
Yeah, and the guy that runs it, his name is Johnny Stewart, and he's kind of like one of those entertaining madmen, you know. And when you watch videos, interviews of him and stuff. So, but yeah, I think Six Flags Over Georgia, I think they actually had one of these shows when I was growing up, and I wasn't really interested.
Lame. This looks really lame.
Oh, it's impressively lame. Like, watch a clip or two. The point being, I when I put on a clip a few days ago, I instantly got like fake Cheech and Chong. So.
Oh, this looks awesome. Thank you for bringing up Legends in Concert, which I'm now going to be watching on YouTube as soon as this is over.
And do chase that with a few interviews with its creator, Johnny Stewart. So I think that's his name. just one of those highly entertaining madmen, you know?
And where did that tangent come from? Remind me.
Was this a fake Cheech? This is the real Cheech.
Okay, right. And so that does also have a fake Cheech Marin somewhere in it.
Yes. Yeah. Where they're trying to do the stand up bits on stage, but it's, you know, impersonators doing it. So
he was clearly one of my favorite characters in this movie. I think for me, Cheech Marin sort of made it like he kept it moving along. Like the comedic relief was awesome for his particular character. Like he was my favorite character, I think.
No, Disney liked him. He shows up as the hyena in The Lion King. So we'll have him back before too long. The thing that I guess the source material is kind of what maybe put a wall between this in a bit, because I have like a relatively strong hatred for Charles Dickens. Ninth grade English. I read every book.
Explore that a little bit.
I read every book assigned. I read a lot. But yeah, we had to read Great Expectations and it wasn't what I expected. So I stopped after the first two chapters. I just guessed on the test. I didn't even bother with the cliff notes. I just guessed. Got a 67 on the test and got an A in the class because I'd read every other book in the class.
You're allowed to, right?
It's like, exactly. I was like, this is my
good karma.
Yeah. All at once. Well, he was paid by the word, wasn't he? Wrote for newspapers. So, so I have not read Charles Dickens. That completely turned me off to even bothering. So Tale of Two Cities, the most I know about that is Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. So yeah. I mean, obviously Oliver Twist is a story that I think people have probably heard, you know, seen the musical Oliver. That's probably, I know I saw that when I was a kid, but not since the 80s. Yeah. So I don't know. What's your take on Dickens?
Honestly, I used to like the Christmas plays when I was younger. Like the Dickens, out of all of the different plays, they were probably the coolest ones just because it felt more real. Like it was about this, and I guess maybe this built towards my conspiratorial mindset, right? But it's about the one guy in town that runs what? The publishing company, essentially, right? Oh, crap. Maybe I'm Ebenezer Scrooge with Scrooge running like the one place in town that can provide for this, you know, this whole community. And he's like this crotchety old grump. And it kind of presents this whole them against us and the, you know, the division of the classes. And it presents it in such an easy way for a child to understand, because it's like this little broken boy isn't going to even have, you know, something to eat on Christmas Day. And then, you know, this guy who employs the dad. So it sets that whole dichotomy up. But then I learned later on that there's all of these interpretations where Scrooge is kind of like the good person in the story, and that the rest of the town really are kind of just being really lazy. It's sort of a funny interpretation, but when I read that, it just made me think like, oh man, maybe there is something more to this story.
They should just do a remake it with Rupert Murdoch, right? That'd be fun.
I mean, I love it. And I guess maybe just the movie Scrooge is playing into it. Like there's just been so many awesome, and I'm getting this right? This is Charles Dickens.
Yes, so that's correct. Like you are correct.
But I think Charles Dickens' work in general lends itself so well to great adaptations. Now, does that improve the merit of Charles Dickens, or is it just a coincidence that it's been, you know, sort of reprogrammed over and over, but done very well? Like the Scrooge movie series, and just, you know, the Scrooge in general as a character is going to outlive people that even know who created it, right? So I think that there's something very alluring about that. And I don't think it's some of that is just all dumb luck and marketing. I think there's like an actual archetype that is so easy to understand, but it's also done in a way that didn't get censored, or, you know, I don't know, like the childhood rhymes, right? Ring around the rosy pocket full of posy. When you look into them, it's all about kind of death, right? It's about covering up the stench of death, but it outlives its original intent. And I'm just fascinated with that kind of stuff. So on that level, Charles Dickens is fascinating to me because his work is timeless, regardless of the merit of the work itself. Now, when it comes to his writing, I'm sort of exactly with you, like outside of the Christmas stuff, just because I guess it's embedded into my brain at this point, like binary or like an old piano with the notches, right? But for Oliver Twist, I remember I was supposed to read that and I might have just kind of skimmed the back and, you know, amalgamated what it was about and wrote a book report based on the back summary of the book.
You put more work than I did into that then.
Yeah, I mean, it was also for the Pizza Hut. Like, you would, if you read a bunch of books, you would earn Pizza Hut points, then you could use those to auction and get stuff. I don't know if you remember that.
Actually I do, because I did read a lot. So that was an issue. Well,
I kind of gamed the system though, because I would just go to the library and just write reports on the back, you know, based on the back of the books, and turn them in and just hoard in the points for those Pizza Hut auctions.
but my big beef is the dense Victorian prose, right? That's the thing that's getting me. I've also never read Moby Dick, but no one ever assigned it to me, and I wasn't, of course he's an American writer, but also just kind of just that 19th century unreadable. Like, I prefer reading translated books from the 19th century most of the time.
How are you on Hemingway?
Hemingway. Yeah. All the sentences are short now. It's great. and unless they run on, but they don't have giant words in there. So yeah, I loved Hemingway. You know, I did my 18, 19 year old tear through Vonnegut, that sort of thing. Right. So, I'm trying to think of the oldest. Yeah, I liked reading Greek dramas, like, again, because they were like translated, so the language was reasonably okay. Yeah, so
don't have to read it in Greek or Latin, right?
Right. So I just want language I can understand in my book, I guess, is the thing.
Do you read any literature in Japanese, or is? Do you just stick to English books still?
I've read children's books in Japanese. That's about it. So no, I don't is the answer. My language learning skills are pretty raw, to be perfectly honest. My Japanese is not good.
That's awesome. That's so American, and I love it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the nice thing is you're on a crowded train, crowded restaurant. You really can just tune everyone out, you know? So it's great. it's fun. This movie, I guess, as we get into it, the original plot also had a little more Disney darkness, where Oliver's cat parents were like murdered by the Dobermans, the Doberman dogs from, oh God, what's the protagonist?
Oh, see, that would have provided a much needed sort of connection, though, between the end and the beginning, I think.
Yeah, and they just, I mean, probably correctly, it was like, yeah, this movie's going to be kind of light, so maybe we don't want that in this one.
I feel like it was missing, though. Like there was a missing piece, obviously, because almost every other Disney movie starts with this very dramatic, traumatic, you know, entrance. And this one, it was just like someone left the box of kittens outside on a road, and there was just one that ended up being the last to be picked. And that was sort of the first initial tragedy, and it just felt like, yeah, there was something missing there from the Disney proxy.
Okay, so maybe you would have gone with that. I mean, this is the first Disney animated movie that Eisner and Katzenberger are fully in the cockpit for. It's the first animated Disney movie that no longer has any of the nine old men involved. This is, you know, fully the new crew now. So they might have been trying to like hew a slightly different path on purpose.
That, or was this Giuliani or Ed Koch? I mean, because I wonder if like whoever was running New York at the time in 88 was like, hey, take that part out. Like, we don't kill cats here. You know what I mean?
Maybe behind the scenes. I don't know. So unfortunately,
you know, they're all on speed dial. I mean, they're, or at least they're on like the first few pages of speed dial.
Yeah, for the 80s, all I can imagine those the Ghostbusters mayor. That's all I've got in my head. So I did. We had a class trip to New York City, I think 1993. So it was like right on the cusp, which was fun. And for some reason, they had us at a hotel like right off of Times Square. So it was just like sleazy as hell. Maybe like a year or two later, it wasn't, but it still was in 1993.
Did you all go to FAO Schwartz?
I was in there at some point. I don't know. If
I feel like you would have remembered it if you brought a bunch of kids to FAO Schwartz, but maybe not.
Well, these are junior high schoolers, so we would have been like a little more.
I mean, still, I don't know. Maybe I just was a very late bloomer, but I think I went, well, maybe not junior high, but yeah. But FAO Schwartz was magic. Like seeing toys that were bigger than you, but it was like the actual toys was mind blowing. And since you're in the middle of New York, there's always interesting characters inside the store too.
I might be thinking of, my memories might be the movie Big is my problem. Now, the specific memory I have from that trip is really stupid. That is buying the Fish album Hoist and Green Day's Dookie at the Sam Goody's inside the Empire State Building. That stuck in my head for some reason. I don't know why, but yeah, it's kind of weird sometimes what sticks in your head and what does not. So I just remember it was sleazy enough still in 1993 that the class president tried to buy a fake ID and got mugged. So that was exciting.
That's nice. Yeah, I used to go to New York every summer because it's where most of my family was from anyways. I think around that same time too, I was like maybe shoplifting like Quasimodo CDs or something. Allegedly.
Allegedly. I think there's a statute of limitations eventually there.
Yeah, no, I think we're well beyond that. I don't even think that does Tower Records even exist anymore.
It doesn't.
It wasn't Tower. I can't remember what the name was. It might have been Tower.
Yeah. No, we actually still have them in Japan, although they've finally become kind of a shadow in the past couple of years. So they ripped out at least the one here. Well, even the ones in Tokyo, they've made the stores much smaller. They now just have giant displays for K-pop acts where they used to have catalogs of jazz and rock. So
I think at one point there's going to be a complete switch where right now it's gotten almost cheap, like 99 cents, please buy the single, it's only 99 cents, you know, or like go to Starbucks and buy this coffee and we'll give you this single for free for 99 cents. And at some point it's going to be like, sit in this booth and listen to this song for a minute and we'll pay you, we'll give you credits or something. I really feel like there's going to be sort of a flippening at some point.
Well, and Disney News, I just saw an article like maybe last week or something that in Australia, Disney is no longer going to release physical media of their movies. Guardians 3 is the last one they're going to release in Australia. After that, it's all going to be digital, which is, you know, that's going to be the same, I think, other places within a couple years. So,
I mean, it kind of is digital anyways at this point, or at least all the archives and everything. When the studios transfer it between studios, at least they're never going to be transferring anything other than a hard drive if it's physical media. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess it's just you can't even, you know, they're not even going to make them anymore in Australia. So it's like, oh, that's a little bit of a mile mark there, isn't it?
I mean, could this just be upping the stakes on the Disney Vault, where now it's almost like Disney Vault Max, right? So now if they actually do a physical release of something in 5 years from now, and it's like, oh, they haven't released anything. Are they ever going to release anything again? We better get our hands on this one. And now you can sell these little pieces of plastic for 5X. Like, you don't have to sell 500 times them, right? You could just sell the same one for 50 times the price.
Yeah. I mean, that, you know, that was a big deal about this time. Like, what do we do with the Disney Vault? Because through the 60s, 70s, and the first half of the 80s, it was simple. We re-release a different film in the theaters every year, make some bank off of it, and call it a day. So, you know, and now by this time, about 1988, they're having to reconsider that business model. Again, this one, Oliver Company, is interesting in that it, from 1989, I think they did put all of their releases, at least their new releases, on home video. But Oliver and Company did not show up on physical media or home media until 96. So besides the movie being a little slight, like you mentioned, I think that also might be where this one isn't. It is the start of the Disney Renaissance. It just didn't feel like it because the movie was.
And I must have seen this one in the theater because it was like triggering me. There was NLP anchors firing off left and right from the musical tunes and little phrases and even some of like the visuals of it. But if it didn't come out on video until 96, then I mean, I probably didn't care about this in 96. I was well on my way into high school at that point.
Yeah, yeah. So I and that's why I've heard the title. I recognize the poster, but I'm pretty sure I never encountered the movie before. I got a little thrown off by the voice cast because I start the movie and it's like Joey Lawrence. I'm like, oh yeah, Joey Lawrence. I'm like, oh no, that's Billy Joel. Joey Lawrence is little Joey Lawrence. He is voicing Oliver. So,
whoa,
yeah. Because I don't know. I was just extrapolating listening to Dodger. Hey, I'm the Dodger. And I'm like, oh, okay, that sounds like Joey Lawrence, right? But it's not. That's Billy Joel in his only acting role where he is not playing Billy Joel. So that's kind of interesting, too. what are the other stars? I mentioned Dom DeLuise shows up. It did mention that Patrick Stewart was approached to voice Francis, the dog, but was, you know, busy starting Next Gen, so he didn't do it. But
that might have elevated it slightly. No shade thrown at the voice actor who did it, but I think Pat, I don't know, I just love Patrick Stewart, so I'm
biased. Oh yeah, Patrick Stewart elevates everything, doesn't he? And of course Bette Midler is Georgette, who I guess she's about as much of an actor as she is a singer, especially in the 80s. So
props. I mean, I don't think that I agree with her on any sort of position, reality, politically, morally, on at all. But
oh, I don't know.
Definitely a great cast for this. Absolutely a great cast for this.
I will say I was not particularly into the music. Like the opening theme made me think of, you know, a sitcom theme. You know, like it's like the Full House or the Family Matters theme, right? That was the jib of that tune to me. So we got a song, you know, Billy Joel contributed a song, Huey Lewis in the News. I'm like, I don't know. That doesn't really do it for me for a Disney movie.
No, it didn't. The only thing musically that stood out to me was that this, as it opens up, kind of keeping with that same motif of being, I'm going to say, like the first modern American movie, I guess, in the 80s. if you add all those qualifiers, eventually it becomes a fact. So, but the very beginning, it kind of starts out with like a hip hop beat, like there's someone playing a boombox in the middle of, you know, New York City. And then as Oliver transitions from that scene to the next one, he goes into like another little alley and ends up in like a little Latin neighborhood, and then like playing salsa. And I just thought that those were almost like the first two times I'd heard modern music, or at least modern to 1988, and I had like modern fashion and everything. So just playing on top of that, the music was kind of interesting, and it was like a harken back to like, oh yeah, that's kind of what Disney said hip hop sounded like in 88, which isn't, you know, it's kind of like it's like a weird rosy glasses to look through.
It's had to be the first Disney movie with some hip-hop in it, even if there's
a lot of
fake
firsts in this one, man. There's a lot of firsts, and there's also, and I don't want to read too much into it, but I kind of want to read too much into it just because, you know, I guess
that's the point of what we're doing
here, right? So there's this concept in NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, which is just a kind of like a silly sales pitchy name for it. But anyways, this concept in NLP called embedding stories or embedded language. And to put it in like a quick way, I guess, if you were going to tell a really long story, right, you would tell that story and then lead up to like just before you kind of get to the point or the climax of it, and you stop yourself and you say, actually, that reminds me of this other story I want to tell you real quick. And then you jump into that story, right? And you tell the whole thing, and then you finish it and you collapse it. And then you say, okay, now back to that original story. And then you finish that story and then you collapse it. what it kind of does is that the outer story is the one that you're going to remember later that day, maybe in like an hour, maybe the next day or something. But that inner story is potentially something that you're going to remember a lot longer from then. It might not be accessible to you immediately, but in like maybe a few months or years or whatever, you'll still remember details of that inner story more than the outer story based on, you know, a bunch of woo-woo research and stuff based on how much you believe this.
Well,
but this movie, sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying that's kind of true for podcasting. I mean, the parts of the podcast you tend to remember the best are the weird random tangents, right? So then you can't remember which episode it was in because that wasn't the main point.
that's actually a great, and honestly, NLP in a lot of ways is just some scientists sat down and picked up what worked in terms of rhetoric. Like, what ways do humans communicate with each other that makes it most efficient? And then if you just got a bunch of weird science nerds and stuck them in a room for a while and they just dissected it, and then they kind of come up with like the distilled elements of what makes rhetoric work. And it's also, I think, you know, my opinion, why the concept of rhetoric, which is one of the original seven classic liberal arts, is no longer really taught, right? It was the trivium, quadrivium. So it was grammar, logic, rhetoric. And since we don't teach rhetoric anymore, it's almost like this mystical thing when people have this awareness of how to, you know, use influence, especially if it's not within the specific areas of advertising, you know, marketing or politics. If it's not in those areas, then there's almost no use for it in sort of the modern world, I guess. So anyways, the whole concept of that, though, is that I really do see a lot of this kind of happening in Oliver Twist, where we've got this like, and I want to say, if we take the Disney proxy, right? My little Disney proxy theory is that Disney replaces your parents with IP immediately. And then so they can sell you, you know, Happy Meals or whatever later down the line. But in this movie, as we already noted, it was kind of missing the original, the dogs eat Oliver's parents, apparently. Again, that would have made this make even more sense. But even if you ignore that aspect, these kittens, they start in this box and then Oliver's stranded and alone. Okay, so that you imagine you put the kid down in front of the movie and the parents walk away. Now it's just the TV is babysitting the child. So the child is identifying with the other child who's just been abandoned. You know what I mean? Like, there's no parents around. And it's just up to him to kind of figure his way through the world. And then as he figures his way through the world, he goes into a house and then gets kidnapped from the house and then says, no, I want to go back to the house. And then on his way back to the house, gets kidnapped from that. So if you were to imagine this concept of an embedded story, that's three stories deep, essentially, right? That inner kidnapping, the outer kind of fake kidnapping where like his friends came to quote unquote rescue him. And then the original dilemma that he was put in, where it's just this box abandoned in the world. So it just keeps collapsing inward. I mean, it's Disney Inception in a way when it comes to the Disney proxy, because every one of those tragedies, as I believe in this, you know, traumatic programming, each one of those is a different kind of phase. And as the kid is identifying with this other kid going through that, I feel like if Disney, you know, if we were to entertain the idea that there's an MK Ultra scientist on the back of some, you know, screen and Disney room with their hand on the dial, it really does feel like this is them just going, let's just turn this up a little tiny bit. And like, whoops, let's, you know, they kind of slipped a little bit. And it has this weird, like, why does he get kidnapped three times two times? But why are there so many tragedies that wrap this story together? But I find that it helps the movie out dramatically. Like, I kind of love all of the different twists and turns.
And one of them with a distinct side serving of a Stockholm syndrome, right? Because they get him out of the house. It's like, why'd you do that? That's where I want
to be. Maybe it was in Stockholm, though, but it was like he was just getting like loved on. He didn't have to go back out into the streets and hustle anybody. He kind of found like a sugar mama, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, I'm just talking about the general concept of your Stockholm syndrome, right? I mean,
oh, right.
It is a nice young girl, right? Who also, you know, Jenny is obviously very close to Penny, so that's where this had some seeds in being a Rescuer sequel.
This was Jenny from the block, though.
Yeah, it's like basically the same character, I guess. I don't remember. Well, Jenny's background was what, like, well, just living on a disturbing boat with a disturbing woman, I guess, was the setup in the Rescuer. So Like, this one's not that dark.
I think in The Rescuer, she was more of like a victim. Like, there was there's probably a creepy backstory to that one.
No, this does have Jenny's very absent parents, which is, I guess, you know, if you wanted, it's much
another
lighter than,
level of that Inception, right? So like even the child that Jenny herself is rescuing, like, she can't help out entirely because her parents also sort of abandoned her. So yeah, I mean, all of that. Then there's so much more. Like, I'm just kind of oversimplifying that concept, but as you go through in your notes, and if you're going to watch this movie after watching this, I guess keep that in mind about these like inner and outer shells of trauma.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, because what is the one that I was thinking, oh, this would traumatize an 8-year-old watching the film, or a 4-year-old or whatever, where it's like, oh, sorry, no, your parents are not going to be here for your birthday, you know, to your average preschooler. That's like, oh, my God, that's the end of the world, you know?
I mean, it's a strong character development for a young kid, but also for adults, right? Because there's an adult that might see that and be like, I miss my dad, or like, you know, that's the same that it was for me. Or so, I mean, Disney's got the, by now, I can clearly say with Oliver and Company, regardless of commercial or critical success, they've kind of got the formula down. Like, whether, you know, they made it in a laboratory or someone just kind of crafted up home style, they kind of have it down now. Like, they've got the beats, and now they can just kind of focus on technology.
Yeah, I will say this one does a very nice, if we're talking technology, you really don't notice the CG stuff too much, which apparently is mostly the inanimate objects in the movie. So
there's a couple places. I mean, but you know, I was kind of looking out for them, and I just noticed them in a few spots. But when you see traffic, like cars or trucks and stuff moving, those are probably the most obvious, because they're just so so exact in their kind of like geometry that doesn't look the same as any other Disney movie before this, except outside of very specific scenes like the clock tower scene in one of the previous movies we saw.
Mouse Detective.
Mouse Detective, yeah.
And yeah, I mean, Roger Rabbit had a little bit of it, but also like weirdly analog stuff that we noticed doing that one. So this is
So I got to ask you, since we just did Roger Rabbit, and you should definitely watch the episode if you haven't seen it. But do you put Roger Rabbit in the same class as all of these other movies, like every other Disney animation before it? And now we're talking about Oliver and all the ones after it, because I sort of still put it in its own like category.
I mostly do. I mean, I think of Roger Rabbit as simply being like a movie and not an animated movie, even though, yeah, it has a ton of animation. But it's not usually lumped in with the, you know, Disney's animated classics or anything. Right. It's kind of left to be its own. I think it ought to be. Well,
I think it really ought to be.
Yeah, I think it probably should. I mean, we just didn't want to skip it. Right. So it made sense for our purposes and our sequence, it makes sense, right? So,
well, we are creators of our own reality here.
Yeah, we've created a new zeitgeist for Disney. No, we haven't. We're just following movies they made. But yeah, I mean, even they,
we are not infringing on anything. Let's get that very clear. We have not infringed. We're not, no,
because Oh, I'm sorry. I just lost that train of thought. Oh, well, let's move on. Now, you say you have a whole lot of notes that are not necessarily on the movie, which I guess maybe we should start diving a bit into those.
Well, I mean, aside from this overarching theme of like the Inception Disney proxy thing going on, I also felt like there was a few other references. Like, one of the big ones for me, and this is probably just personal, but when they introduce the bad guy, right, Sykes, they kind of give him this Dr. Claw entrance. And 1988 would have been peak Inspector Gadget, Dr. Claw, because they show this guy in a chair, over the shoulder shot, looking at something on a screen, and he like pounds his fist on a desk, which at that point, like, this has been the exact animated sequence has been kind of programmed into me. You know, it was like, this is a bad guy. If you ever see an over the shoulder shot and someone pound their fists on the desk, even if they're doing something good, they're kind of the bad guy. So that was a huge one for me. Like, did they do that on purpose? Is that just an archetype that I just never noticed before? And then there was one weird spot in here where Sykes is telling his Fagin to like come inside the building, and he's like, you push the door, you don't pull on it, but it's got like the pull handle, right? And I immediately was thinking, why does it have the pull handle? If it's a push door, why would it even have the pull handle on it? And it kind of like threw me for a dumb rabbit hole that I started going down, but it made me try to think the whole movie in more esoteric terms, because at that point, Sykes didn't make sense. Fagin made kind of sense, but he was like, he had a one foot in both realms. He was kind of like helping, but he was also kind of working for the bad guy. So I started just like, what if these were Jungian archetypes? But we've kind of done that before. And then I started thinking like, well, maybe what if they were tarot cards or something? So I was kind of going through a tarot card deck, and I aligned each of the different characters to some different tarot cards, and it actually like freakishly worked out better than I was expecting it to. So I don't know how familiar or how much you care about tarot or Jungian archetypes.
Oh, I'm down for both. So I'm very curious what cards you're going to attach to these characters.
And this is kind of a cool, because I guess, like, in my opinion, Jungian archetypes and tarot, and even if you wanted to get into like Kabbalah and tracing the tree of life and the Sephiroth and going through all the stages, these could kind of just be different ways of interpreting the same sort of, you know, more abstract concepts. Like, it's just a bunch of different people from different backgrounds and time periods that are explaining this abstract thing that you can't draw a picture of because it's just too abstract for that.
A few years ago,
is just one of those.
Yeah, a few years ago, I actually, while we were bored at work, I gave my coworker a reading, right? And it was like surprisingly bad. And I'm like, oh, that's weird. And then he proceeded to have like the worst year ever. So I was like, oh.
Oh, God. Did you? I mean, you may have like done that to him.
I hope not. But
you ever consider that? I mean, that's kind of where I'm at. I feel like if you were ever to give someone a tarot reading or any kind of reading, and the things that you said came true, I would put way more of my money on you causing those things to have happened than you being prophetic.
I'm a bad coworker.
But I mean, maybe. Unless you were like MK Ultra, like secretly, you know, whispering into his ear, playing like a looped recording of like, I will fail. Then I wouldn't put too much of it on you. But yeah, you were kind of like the direct cause of it, maybe.
Yeah, probably. And then another coworker, I guess he was just trying to get rid of his stuff. So about 6 months ago, he gave me this nice leather-bound tarot set. And I got a couple books about the I Ching and tarot on my bookshelf there that I have not read yet. But
okay, well, so you're fairly versed, at least in the major and minor arcana, I assume.
Yeah, right? That's why I'm saying, hey, yeah, throw out what you're attaching these guys
to. So Oliver, to me, is an obvious fool. That one's kind of the easy give me, right? Because the fool is the guy who isn't necessarily foolish. The fool is just somebody that has embarked on a new path, and they're kind of approaching the world with fresh eyes, almost like a child would. So a lot of people get that misunderstood, where they think the fool means like the idiot. It's not the same thing. If anything, the fool can be a very good thing, especially if it's at the beginning of a story. You might not want to draw the fool card at like the midpoint of your story, but you know, everyone's different, you know, different strokes for different cartoon folks or whatever.
And so I will say that when you said it, that was the only one that I was like, oh, I guess Oliver is a fool. And
he kind of has to be, right? Especially when you go through this like hero cycle of any story, which we've already kind of established, Disney has a formula. So at this point, I haven't even done this. I just did this kind of as fun, but I would almost imagine we could draw these same tarot cards for like the next movie that comes up. And they might even come in like the same sequence and everything. I don't have the gumption to actually like sit down and keep track of if it's the same sequence, but if anyone does, so Oliver the Fool, because he's, you know, innocence, he's spontaneity, new beginnings, like he's kind of the fool. Like, you know, let's not even argue about that one. Dodger is in the middle, but I think he's maybe the magician, because Dodger represents skill and resourcefulness and more importantly, transformation, because Dodger is ultimately, like, if we were to say this was Sword in the Stone, right? Dodger is kind of Merlin, and you know, and Oliver is sort of the, I'm trying to remember the kid's name from Sword in the Stone, but it's kind of dead to me now. So,
well, you got I mean, you got the Jungle Book with a similar trajectory. Although I will say,
it's the formula,
despite Dodger being voiced by Billy Joel, for some reason, it doesn't feel as weird in Oliver and Company. I guess maybe because you're like Dodger, Artful Dodger, and Oliver Twist are, you know, he's only
Here's the difference is that Dodger is clearly socially acclimated. There's other healthy, well, I mean, arguably, but there's lots of other people that rely on him and look to him. Whereas that wizard thing, it's like the old guy that lives in the woods and he's a complete recluse and he doesn't have any social skills. That's, in my opinion, that's kind of what makes it creepy. So Dodger is, I think that they've locked in, like, okay, whoever the adult character is that comes in and serves as that proxy maybe needs to be socially acclimated and have other, like, healthy relationships with the world. And it works here, I think.
So are you willing to call Merlin the magician?
Well, so I'll say Dodger's the magician. Dodger's the Merlin here a little bit.
Okay.
But he's still, because he's ultimately the one that's responsible for transforming the fool. And then you've got Jenny, which I'm going to say is the Empress. I mean, there's other ones that she could probably fill in here, but the Empress being like the nurturing, the abundance, the, you know, agricultural female entity. So that's kind of a give me. Sykes, for an obvious reason, he can kind of be like the devil, I would assume, but not just because he's the bad guy, but because he really does represent the materialism. He keeps dogs on chains, you know what I mean? He's like chained to the physical world and of like greed and gambling, and he kind of represents the ultimate seedy underworld of this New York City that we kind of like started out on. So it's almost like if you were to take all of the bad parts of New York, whatever a kid might imagine the bad parts of New York are in 1988, and put it into a character, that's kind of what Sykes is. It's like, oh, that's the guy that's behind all the murders and the marijuana. You know what I mean? Like, he's the bad guy. So I think that he kind of represents the devil. And then Fagin was kind of my favorite out of all these, because in the Jungian archetype, for sure, he's kind of the shadow in a way, just, or like maybe the trickster, because he feels a little bit outside of the story itself. Like, he doesn't have to adhere to either of the rules, and long-winded way of getting here, but this is when the devil and Fagin have this interaction, and Fagin, I'm going to make him abstract Wheel of Fortune, because I see him as a catalyst. And again, this catalyst being outside the system, because when Fagin tells him, push the door, don't pull it, it's the only part in the entire movie where something clearly nonsensical happened. Because again, if you think about it, it flies in, you see the Twin Towers, you see the real New York, Kodak, Coca-Cola, like all of the, they have a Ryder moving truck in one of the scenes, you know, they've taken all this great stake to be very detailed. And it was just a silly little throwaway joke of like, maybe someone was reading too much Gary Larson Far Side and they were like, put in the, you know, push the door, pull the door joke. But it didn't have the comedy to it, because why is this horrible, evil devil guy that might hurt you installing backwards door handles just to, you know, mess with you? And that's when I was like, okay, Fagin doesn't actually exist in this reality. Or if he does, he's kind of that interdimensional shadow being that acts as the catalyst between the hero and the bad guy, and kind of tells the hero what he needs to do, without necessarily helping him directly, because that would have destroyed the karmic balance between good and bad, right? Or am I reading way too much into that? Or is that?
Oh, you are, but it's fun. And I mean, you do start thinking about the same thing, like we were talking about with Merlin. You start applying, like, where does this fit in other movies and why, right? Again, the rescuers, that's kind of like a weird alternate reality with well, it's not Cruella de Vil, it's whatever the name was there, but yeah, it's like they have a weird swamp alternate reality where they have their, like, you know, victim slave or whatever, so,
and they can ride crocodiles like they're like airboats.
Exactly. I mean, that's kind of yeah. You know, they have this material boat at least, and they're trying to get material gems or what were they looking for? A diamond or something? So,
well, and yeah. At no point in that movie did it portray itself as being so realistic I mean, in every Disney movie, animals talk, right? So you can't really get over that aspect of suspending your disbelief. But when it comes to Oliver and Company, this is gritty. This is, you know, this is hip hop. You know, this is people listening to boomboxes. And I guess the original version was, and here's Dobermans tearing apart a family of cats. So it feels like they meant to be gritty. There wasn't a lot of slapsticky, nonsensical stuff, except this damn door handle, man. So I'm sorry if I'm stuck on the door handle, but I feel like it's the key to something. Like, we need to figure out how to unlock that door.
Go through the door. Okay.
There's got to be a way to pull it open, man. They're like, instead of pushing it in, you got to be able to pull it open.
Do you have cards for anyone else? I'm thinking Georgette probably deserves one.
Georgette has one. Tito deserves one. He's going to be the Knight of Wands from the Minor Arcana because energy, adventure, impulsiveness. What else do you gotta say, right?
But he doesn't get one of the major cards.
I don't see major and minor. You know, they're all equal. All the tarot cards are equal to me. They serve their different individual roles. And in fact, we only agree upon one standard of tarot, but there's so many different tarot decks. My favorite is, like, there's a Saturnian, like Italian tarot that they found in Pompeii. Anyways, completely different tangent we should do for another episode. Tito is the Knight of Wands, fiery spirit, impulsiveness. I mean, it's, that kind of represented him. Georgette is going to be the Queen of Cups, also from the Minor Arcana, because she kind of stands now, open to you know, debate or interpretation here. They clearly show her as like a bad guy in this movie, but I also think that she's in New York, right? She's lived in New York her entire life. She's seen the ups and the downs and everything. So she's a survivor. And I think that maybe any of the malintent that you might attribute to her originally, it's really just her looking out for herself and surviving. Like, anyone that just lives by themselves in New York City would have to do at that point, right? So I don't hold it against her that she was almost trying to push Oliver out, because at the very end she comes around anyways. So that's why I have to justify Queen of Cups here, because that kind of stands for intuition, emotion, and grace. Because you have to admit, she is kind of graceful. Like, she does represent those things, even if there's a little bit of narcissism in there. So I don't know. I liked her character, and I feel like then this isn't an endorsement of this aspect of it, but there was a little bit of the E word, you something or other, when in the early 1900s, when they just wanted to breed, like, she makes lots of references to being very well bred, for example, and that how those attributes of her breeding is what makes her good. And she even makes it implicate, I can't remember here, I've got the exact lyric written down though,
and she's
not for
bitch.
Not for vanity, but for humanity. So that was her justification for why a dog is putting on makeup. And first of all, it's like, why does a dog have to be? Anyways, it wasn't for her vanity. It was just for all of humanity to not expose them to, I guess, things that aren't beautiful. And again, that kind of goes in with some of the tarot reading. But then she also says, shows how the breeding shows. So like, it was this double entendre, another collapse, you know, sort of NLP programming here, but shows how the breeding shows, like a breeding show where they parade the dogs around and you vote on them based on how well they've been bred, right? Which is a direct correlation. But it's also this humanized dog, right? So it's no longer a dog breeding show, but now it's like a human dog hybrid breeding show, which starts taking on weird connotations there.
That's why you can't do it here, because the animals are the characters. But I do like the movie Best in Show, where they're basically taking all of these attributes and throwing them onto the owners, right? Well, the dogs are literally just walking around oblivious, because that's what probably is the real case. So, of course, they do it. You know, it's a pretty funny movie, so that's how they go about it.
I wonder, is that can't be American in nature, right? They've been having dog breeding competitions since before America existed, I assume. That's probably why dogs even exist.
Yeah, that movie's based in the States. But yeah, it seems like something you'd be rolling in the old country for sure.
So Einstein is going to be strength, bravery, compassion, like the actual card of strength. Rita, I kind of see. I mean, we're getting to the side characters here. Rita's the high priestess. which might also sound surprising, but this is the intuition, mystery, and subconscious knowledge. And this is because Rita's the one that actually gives wisdom and guidance to Oliver. She's the only one that really gives him like this in-depth understanding of the world and not just the rules of how to like act within it, which is kind of the role of Dodger. Like Dodger understands the mundane rules, right? But I think Rita gives him, I guess, more insight. And then finally, Francis has to be the Hierophant because he represents tradition. He represents spiritual guidance and conformity. I mean, that's like his role is to do those things.
Yeah, yeah. I know. Yeah, the last year I was like sitting here struggling with like which dog was that, but so maybe that was the part that was deep, but too deep. But the first couple, yeah, definitely. And I do like that the High Priestess though would be kind of buried in there, you know, not the obvious character. So, I mean, I guess that's kind of how they play the Oracle in the Matrix, which would have sort of a similar role. Maybe I don't know. I guess that one's a whole can of its own worms, but.
And it really does too. I made some other notes on like how this one was more silly, but if it was progressing through the planet archetypes, how would the passage of Oliver through New York City be correlated to a passage through the classical planets back when they thought, you know, sun and moon were planets. So it's, and it really lays like directly on top, almost as if it was someone made this map out. The planets don't go in order, but it would be the sun starting out of obviously, you know, the fool, the ego, the new rising sun, that's ego, identity, vitality. Then it goes in directly into the moon. And this is Oliver trying to search for a home. You know, the moon is like this forever wandering, detached, you know, like mother that can't get close to her son. And then you've got Mercury. This is Oliver meeting Dodger, which again fits directly into Dodger being the magician slash the trickster, the catalyst, right? Mercury, Quicksilver, that was kind of seen alchemically as like a catalyst component. Venus, which is love, beauty, harmony. That's obviously him meeting Jenny. That's his first real touch with like this feminine energy. So that's kind of the Venus. Then you've got Mars, where we've got the conflict with Sykes, the ultimate evil. You know, here's this battle that's starting to emerge. Jupiter, which represents luck and expansion. So this is him coming together with Dodger and the crew and like kind of forming together a plan. You've got Saturn, and this is discipline and challenges. And this is kind of like the karmic expenditure, which also correlates towards the end of like a climax, right? This is where you're actually going to spend all of the karma that you've built up. And this is where he actually gets abandoned and some of the hardships that he goes through. And then finally, Neptune. We're going to skip Uranus because it's fun to say, but I just had to say Uranus. And then Neptune is Oliver's dream of like that better life, because Neptune represents sort of like that, the dream realm. And it's kind of like the farthest away in that regard. So anyways, yeah, that was another answer. I had the Jungian, the tarot, and maybe like the planetary alignment breakdowns of it.
No, I like that. You definitely start throwing on movies and thinking, you know, I like the tarot approach. Yeah. I'm not sure I've heard that used for a media look before, but hey, that's what
I was
do
inspired
here.
By the Winnie the Pooh one, because everyone does the like diagnosis of Winnie the Pooh. So that's when we were, you know, going through and assigning all of them different archetypes. So I feel like it'll be interesting if we do like a different rating scale for the movies now.
Who do they apply to? Yeah.
The next one will be like which G.I. Joe character? You know, this is going to turn into like a social media trivia, isn't it?
Well, and He-Man, I guess Orko's the fool. That's fun. Okay. I don't know why that came to my mind first, but hey, maybe that's
Orko was the original magic. Jar Jar Binks, wasn't he?
Oh, I don't know. I liked Orko when I was a kid. The toy, you it had a like
no,
a
no, the plastic. The toy as a kid, it's cool. Go back and watch Orca as an adult and imagine just hearing that nonstop in the background. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess some kids did like Jar Jar Binks. So
I liked that movie, to be honest. I didn't like Jar Jar Binks, the character, but I liked the movie. And apparently I was shunned for having that opinion at the time. And maybe even now, I think even now that like that outs me.
Yeah, I was thinking like I rewatched a few years ago and yeah, I didn't. And I'm not.
I didn't hate Anakin, man. I mean, if Casey, the off chance that he ever hears this, I didn't hate you, man. That was a decent decent job for a decent role, man. I don't know.
It's a kid. What can you do? So, I mean, I just did a podcast from Return of the Jedi and I was like, yeah, I'm fine with the Ewoks. I had, you know, I didn't have teddy bears. I had Ewoks. So,
and they ate people, right? Ewoks ate people.
Oh, they should. Yeah. I don't know. Oh, yeah.
Am I making that up?
They're trying to cook our heroes. So that would, you would
correct
assume that they're also going to eat our heroes. So, yeah, good point. Maybe that's why.
I mean, they're cute and cuddly and they eat people.
Well, that's like, you know, some bears, right?
Or dogs or cats. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's plenty of cute animals that will rip you apart and then try and eat you, probably. So that's the fun of the animal kingdom. I don't know if any of the, well, yeah, no, we got some dogs that'll rip you a new one in here, don't that almost oh,
there's,
happens.
There's
to
cases
Pagan.
All the time where they find someone that like died in their apartment or their house with their animals, and the animals will wait maybe like a day or two before they start eating their face.
The dingo ate my baby. Yeah. Okay.
I guess this episode is actually sponsored by Purina Cat Chow.
Yummy.
Buy your cat Purina before it eats your face. That's a new tagline.
That's a good one. This is the first time I think I tuned out a little bit for the chase climax of this one, because I wrote in all caps loud noises, which is what I do in my notes when I'm just kind of like tapping out a bit of a movie. I think it's the first one of the Disneys where I've gotten to my loud noises typing. So.
Yeah, I mean, this one also kind of like, because of that outer and inner thing, which may be intentional, maybe not, but because of that, once they start wrapping it up, this was still only an hour and 14 minutes. It was definitely not like on the longer side of the spectrum for Disney movies. So it almost felt like if they started and they got halfway in, they shouldn't have also had like, the we're going to rescue you and then you get snatched during that rescue and then you go back home. There almost needed to be an hour and a half, 2 hour movie. I'm kind of glad they didn't for the movie's sake. But in order for it to all tie up nicely, they just kind of like collapse it all at the very end. And in, I guess in NLP terms, you can also do that, but it has a slightly different effect than when you gradually sort of collapse those stories in and out. So I don't know, maybe like on my deathbed, I'll be like, oh, now I know about that door. Like, that's why he couldn't open it.
I just figured it out. Now I shall open the door. The keys to the universe found in Oliver and Company. But hey, you know, I guess we did find quite a bit in here, didn't we, in the end? Or at least we extrapolated quite a bit, which you can also do if you want to. So. You know, it's like, that's sort of the point of doing this is to overthink it, right?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's easier than others, but this one was surprisingly fun to do. And I have to owe my nostalgia and Disney programming to that, because I don't necessarily know if it was completely based on merit. It really just, I felt like, I don't know, I felt like I got transported back to 1988 for part of this movie. So there's a lot of bias in that. And then Cheech Marin didn't help, you know, in a good way.
I guess like a lot of animes in Japan kind of do that to recreate the cities. They'll just have these hyper realistic looking cityscapes that you can find.
I mean, the movie opens on the Twin Towers, literally. So it's, you know, it's got some of that to it.
Which I did see there was thought in editing that out after 2001, but it was one too much of a problem. People in New York are not. We want to be the New York that was in 1988.
Yeah, forget about it.
But
never forget. But also forget about it. But also never forget about it.
Do both at the same time.
Yeah. I'm walking here.
I think I'm finished with my main points. If you have anything else you want to toss onto this one.
No, man, I think this was a good one. I definitely, technically, there was an upgrade and a downgrade in some ways. The coloring was oddly flat to me. It that part of was like the digital, but I don't know if I would rather have the trade-off of flat colors versus like Xerox, you know, like a coffee stain or dust on some of the intermittent frames. So
this is like, the last movie to use a lot of the Xeroxing method. By the way, but they, by this point, I guess they've just been able to finesse a lot better.
But I guess anytime like the actual animation part came on, like the fluidity of the animation was great, but the color felt very dead to me. Like the matte painting of the background held my eye way more than a lot of the focal characters, which is kind of a no-no in animation, but it also almost felt like there were some growing pains with the digital process at this point, because I think that they probably also digitally colored. I mean, I didn't look into any of the technical aspects, but I just assumed that the whole thing had to be digitally colored because of that.
Yeah, it is interesting going through these films sequentially, because it's like, wow, Disney really was kind of out to pasture, off in the wilderness for like decades, which...
Well, in 1988, this animation, like it's hard to describe this, because when you say animation, like it's such a generic term, but when you actually see like the frame-to-frame animation, like the hand-drawn animation, the number of keyframes and the continuity between those keyframes, like there's obviously like Disney masterful artists behind the way that the figures move and the way that they expand and are emphasized and everything. But if you were to compare like the overall fidelity, like just take a screenshot of anything in this movie of Oliver and compare it to like a popular 1988 Saturday morning cartoon, the Saturday morning cartoon might actually have slightly more interesting, you know, lines and stuff going on. It obviously wouldn't have had the amount of detail because we're comparing a huge screen to a TV screen, different aspect ratios, formats, everything. But like, it wasn't like Disney was leaps and bounds ahead of the competition at this point. If anything, this movie might shows that they were a little bit behind in some of the aspects, not the matte painting, not the fidelity and the skill of the artists, but I guess just in how much time they were putting into like the coloring and stuff. I don't know.
When the late 80s, again,
shade it like the art director of Disney in 1988, you know, what the hell do I know?
No, I mean, looking retrospectively, Don Bluth definitely was like owning them at this point in time as far as like artistic animation.
we have to do like a Don Bluth run after we're expended through the Disney ones and do all the Land Before Times and stuff.
How many are there? There's like 8 of those. I guess only the first.
Yeah, I know. I stopped keeping track after 2 because, you know, you grow older and then you're like, oh man, this like number 23 just came out. This is crazy.
Anyway, yeah, I guess we'll wrap it up for today then. And what's up in your world? It will be late August for the listener, so.
Well, I want to see if you like Oliver and Company or you like Cheech Marin, you should definitely check out my interview with Chong, Tommy Chong, that's on my channel here on, well, where I guess wherever you're listening. Soon, I hope to have it uploaded to all different podcast channels. But for now, it's on my YouTube channel with Tommy Chong. We talk about ghosts and Bigfoot and stuff. It's pretty cool. And then, man, I've got a couple really big, like I've got more than a couple, like 20 huge projects coming out soon. So I'm only going to mention like a handful. One of them is called Frazzle Drip Funhouse. And this is about an animatronic bear that lives in the basement of an arcade run by a death cult. It is definitely a comic or an adults only comic. There's no nudity or anything. It's just incredibly horrifically gory, but also lots of horrible, cheesy like B movie one-liners. It's a love letter to slasher movies and just over the top, you know, horror flicks of the 80s and 90s. So that one's going to be coming out on Indiegogo, and we'll run it for the month of October. Yeah, so if you're listening to this in August, there's plenty of time. So the month of October, we'll be running that. There'll be more information on that on paranoidamerican.com. And then I'm also putting together the final touches on my adult comic series called Illuminati. Ooh. And it's going to be 5 different issues. Each issue is 2 different short stories. And it's got things all the way from the Statue of Liberty coming back to life in 1,000 years from now and having to repopulate America by combining forces with other statues, all like other national monuments all across the country. So that's going to be an interesting one. There's a one where Abraham Lincoln's wife gets bored and invites the Fox sisters over to summon a celestial companion. I've also got a completely illustrated version of John Dee and Edward Kelly when they summoned the angel Uriel and he told them they had to swap wives. And what else? A very 12-page graphically detailed version of Aleister Crowley having relations with Barbara Bush's mom in a really fun story on that one too. So I'm really excited for that series in particular to come out. So yeah, Luminati. I don't even know if it'll be out in August or not. There'll definitely be a soft launch sometime soon. So yeah, pay attention to ParanoidAmerican.com. I think they'll probably be limited to like my Patreon subscribers when I do the soft launches, because usually I'll get like a few hundred first, see how well I do, see if, you know, there's any issues with the story, give them to people that like really are the hardcore adopters, and then I'll do like a crowdfunding campaign and make them more available to like a wider audience. But yeah, so if any of that sounds interesting at all to you, check out the Paranoid American Patreon. And last little plug here too, occulttodecode.com. I've been working on this thing as a side project. It's got a gematria calculator, it's got a date calculator, and for anyone listening, if you use the date calculator and then click on the moon icon in any of the little moons that show up, it'll list like 100 different events that happened on any day in history. So it's actually a incredibly useful tool, and I'll end up charging for it at some point in the future.
All righty. As for this one, it's called Disney. On X, man. Okay. With the artist formerly known as Twitter. We're there. We're kind of on Facebook. So, you know, if you want to contact us there, please do so.
Are you on Threads?
I'm not on Threads myself. I heard Threads had the biggest explosion of new users that promptly all left. So I'm not quite sure what the status of Threads is right now.
It's weird, man. I don't understand it yet, but I'm also getting into that age where I'm like old and don't understand technology.
Yeah, I mean, the same thing kind of happened with Mastodon, where everyone kind of ran there and then just never, nothing ever happened. Oh,
there's so many. There's so fucking many that I've signed up for.
See, Elon Musk already knows that he owns your soul. So that's why you're on X, man. And it's not a cool 90s rave, which is too bad. Okay. I'm going to go chase some cars, I guess, in honor of Oliver and his friends.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.